On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Kuo was a true blue foot soldier for the gung-ho Christian right. He celebrated the Republican Revolution, loathed Bill Clinton, prayed for an evangelical like George W. Bush to take the Oval Office, and helped Bush do just that. Then he went to work in the White House for compassionate conservatism as a top official in President Bush's faith-based initiative. Now David Kuo is out of the White House, charging betrayal and shouting for Christians to head for the hills, to unbuckle a notch from the GOP. The Christian right charges Kuo has been seduced, manipulated, and used for raw politics. Up next on Point, David Kuo, true believer, looks back in anger. Joining me now from New York is David Kuo. He's the former deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and Community for President Bush. He campaigned for George W. Bush's election, joined the White House in 2001, and resigned in 2003. He's now the Washington editor for the BeliefNet website. His new book is Tempting Faith, An Inside Story of Political Seduction. David Kuo, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, Tom, thanks so much for having me.
You're taking all kinds of heat just in the last couple of days here on 60 Minutes Sunday night, and we've got a lot of Christian right leaders coming after you. Did you expect to face that when you came out with this story of your disillusionment with the Bush White House?
You know, I hoped that it wouldn't be true, because it just goes to sort of fulfill my, or to underscore the premise that Christians have gotten so seduced by politics that I think they have a hard time distinguishing the difference between George W. Bush and Jesus.
I want to come back and hear the details of this story, but take us to the bottom line first so we can understand the import as we go along. You got to the point where you were so disillusioned that, number one, you left. Number two, you've written this book, laying it all out. And number three, you're calling for, you say, maybe Christians need to begin a fast from politics. It's sort of, you say, let's take a two-year timeout and cool off here. What was so wrong, so bad, that it has led you to this position, David?
You know, really, it's not something that was, you know, so wrong, so bad, so evil. This has been, you know, a continuing journey for me. The book is an intensely personal story, you know, that covers my time as, you know, from the moment I sort of found God to the moment I fused God and politics together through some very dark times when I became a very nasty partisan person, up to entering the Bush White House, which I entered, as you said, because of the extraordinary promise that President Bush had made on behalf of the poor. But, you know, it was at the White House that everything became most clear, and where I saw the White House manipulation of Christian conservatives, and where I saw so clearly how, you know, willing and loving Christians who wanted just the best of all things and who trusted the president as sort of a pastor in chief were really betrayed and misled over and over again. And where Christian leaders, again, wanting the best things, were betrayed and were let down over and over again. And, you know, and I think that that's an important thing to have pointed out. It's an important thing spiritually, because at the end of the day, you know, there is a big difference between George W. Bush and Jesus, and also because I get concerned about how Jesus is portrayed more and more when I talk to people. I think the idea that a lot of people have is that if I mention Jesus, they may be more worried that I'm going to lobby them on a particular social conservative issue, that I'm going to try and convert them to a particular faith.
You were right in the thick of the Christian right world and were there for a long time. You say right at the start, you know, you've golfed with Ralph Reed and speared fish with John Ashcroft and dined with Bill Bennett and, had foot races with the president himself. What got you into conservative politics? It wasn't your opening bent here. How did you get into that world in the first place, David Kuo?
It's part of the intense nakedness of the book, but in college, I got a woman pregnant, and it was one of those, you know, surprising, unintended pregnancies, and we confronted that reality very quickly, and as kids, and we felt like, oh, gosh, we really didn't have any place to turn. you know, I was a Christian at the time, but I didn't, you know, feel like I could go to my Christian youth group for, frankly, because I was afraid to let them know I was having sex. Mm. Neither one of us felt like we could really go to our parents, which in hindsight wasn't really, really true. But we had the abortion. She had the abortion. And you know, I think that, you know, I expected it to be a morally neutral experience for me, that it wasn't going to make that big a difference. But, you know, I had no idea what I'd done. And it, for some reason, it haunted me morally. And it, the question was, you know, had I betrayed Jesus? Had I become, as some people had said about people who have abortions or who participate in them, a murderer? And, you know, and was the abortion just the abortion of a bunch of meaningless cells? And, you know, and I began to look into those questions and to try and examine it. And, you know, and I eventually ended up sort of fitting abortion into what I felt was my own sort of consistent life ethic. I was, you know, against the death penalty. I was desperately for human rights. I was desperately for policies that helped the poor. You know, and I decided that I was generally for choosing life in abortion as well. You know, again, I didn't know all the details of it and any of that. And so when I came to Washington in 1990, I thought that I would continue what I'd been doing in college, and that was working for Democrats. Mm. And heck, you know, one of the criticisms of me is that I'm a great liberal because I interned for Ted Kennedy and worked at the Robert Kennedy Center for Human Rights, which, you know, I read that makes me a death Democrat. But when I came to Washington, Democrats wouldn't give me a job because it was the highly polarized time around the Webster decision when Roe versus Wade was being called into question. And, you know, I needed a job, so I looked to Republicans. Republicans looked at my resume with Ted Kennedy on it and said, I don't think so. And by one turn of events after another, I ended up at working for a short period of time at the National Right to Life Committee. And I got the job by telling them the story about the abortion and how we struggled with it. But it was the very last time I would ever talk about abortion.
You ended up a very committed political conservative.
Yes, I did. I would never talk about that experience again. I wanted to appear, you know, I wanted to appear very thoughtful and very conservative, much more like William Buckley than someone who was, you know, some confused guest on Oprah. But I became a very, very committed conservative, a very angry Christian conservative. And I don't blame that on anybody but me, please.
And right in the thick of that movement, you worked on George W. Bush's campaign, ultimately the campaign that took him to the White House, and then were recruited to come in at a quite high level with the faith-based initiative. When you came to the White House, David Kuo, what were you hoping for? What were your expectations, and where did you feel let down?
You know, one thing I feel I want to add here, which is, you know, I went through a lot of things that are detailed in the book between sort of coming to Washington and ending up 6 or 7 years later working for President Bush. I had gone through a lot spiritually by the time I'd reached him, and heck, Hillary Clinton had helped me clarify my own faith. But be that as it may, when I met George W. Bush, I found a man of extraordinary compassion, a man who talked about economic and racial and social justice and who clearly meant it. And when I came to the White House in 2001, I came to fulfill what I felt was this extraordinary promise that he made, one of the most extraordinary promises a politician had made to the poor in a generation, and that was, you know, $8 billion a year in aid and assistance to the poor. And he said, you know, I'm not going to be just a liberal who says money by itself is the answer to everything, but I'm also not going to be one of those Republicans who say government should just step out of the way and leave the poor to the private sector. It was really a remarkable speech, a remarkable promise, and it's what moved me to come to Washington and to work on the initiative. But, you know, what did I find? You know, I found confirmation for so many things that I had seen for so long. You know, just in terms of the general apathy of Washington towards the poor, for starters, nobody is really interested in that agenda. Had they been interested in the agenda, the White House couldn't have gotten away with what it got away with, which was, you know, really talking a lot about compassion and doing very little on compassion, but it isn't like there's some great watchdog group out there caring for the poor. But in terms of what happened internally, specifically, you know, we tried to fight very hard to advance the president's faith-based, his compassion agenda. But the biggest obstacle we faced, frankly, those of us in the faith-based office who were there really to just try and fight for this promise, what we faced was just intense opposition from the very high up folks, the West Wing of the White House.
Opposition and, to putting the resources toward stated goal?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, as the months went by and we grew to try and figure out how we could fight for the promise we very much believed the president wanted, we resorted more and more to politics and got to the point where we were able to use politics, specific campaigning for candidates and conferences to recruit other pastors, you know, as a way that we could build political capital, or hoped we could build political capital. And you know, and this went on for a while, and I eventually reached the point where I couldn't do it anymore because it was just deceptive. The pattern that had begun, you know, in the transition and throughout the early days of the administration continued, and it was a pattern of, you know, really big promises and really itty bitty follow up. And you know, at the end of the day, I reached the point of being able to say, I just can't be part of it anymore because, you know, Christians are being deceived into thinking something great is happening. Christian leaders, Christian conservative leaders specifically, were deceived on several occasions into thinking the president had done something extraordinary on this issue of a religious organization's ability to hire and fire based on faith, which wasn't true. You know, and the poor were being used as a political pawn. And, you know, ultimately, I just said, I can't do that anymore. Mm. And I left.
David Cole, you take us places where we normally would not, could not go, including right into the Oval Office. You mentioned President Bush's $8 billion promise for the sort of compassionate conservative agenda. We should read just a little bit from our book about that day when a big group of pastors were waiting to hear from the president. He called you in, I guess, on exactly this point, and off it went from there. Could you take us into that?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was a seminal moment for me because I had been back for maybe a week after a life-threatening illness, and those sorts of illness cause you to, you know, consider your priorities and your threshold for tolerating stuff that
you learned. You had a brain tumor. You had a seizure with your wife in the car. Went off the road. It was really, really calamitous.
Yeah, no, it wasn't very good. 9.5 hours of brain surgery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. During which I was awake, but hey, I got to play rock, paper, and scissors during it. But
you survived that, and here you are in a meeting with ministers, and a colleague whispers to you, the president wants to see you.
Yeah, and so what I write is, I walked in to find the president prowling around behind the desk, looking for something. Quo, tell me about the meeting. I started by telling him that the group wanted to know about the faith-based initiative and what we recommended he talk about, the administrative reforms we had implemented and the tax credits we were still fighting. He interrupted me. Forget all that money. All these guys care about is money. They want money. How much money have we given them? For 2 years, I'd bitten my tongue and told the line. We in the faith-based office didn't speak too loudly or thunder too much. We were nice. I wasn't angry now, but I was no longer willing to lie. Sir, we've given them virtually nothing because we have had virtually nothing to give. He had been looking down at some papers I had given him, but his head jerked up. Nothing? What do you mean we've given them nothing? He glared and angrily pointed out toward the window for no particular reason. Don't we have money in the new programs, like the Compassion Fund thing? Karl Rove was standing next to me in front of the president's desk. He looked stunned. I glanced at him and then looked at the president. No, sir. In the last 2 years, we've given them less than $80 million in new grants. I was probably being generous. What? What do you mean? Karl looked a bit confused, too. But what about the other money, you know, the money we've opened up to new charities? He was remembering our own spin from last winter. Yes, I told the president, because of new regulations, there was technically about $8 billion in existing programs that were now eligible for faith-based groups. But I assured him, faith-based groups had been getting money from those programs for years. $8 billion in new dollars? $8 billion in existing dollars for which groups will find it technically easier to apply. But faith-based groups have been getting that money for years. $8 billion, that's what we'll tell them. $8 billion in new funds for faith-based groups. Okay, let's go. As I walked, I vaguely remembered one of Jesus' parables about only being able to reap what you have sown. We had sown the symbolic seeds of compassion with our constituents. They had accepted them gratefully. We had sown them with the president, too, and he was happy with them. Two interesting follow-ups on that. Mm-hmm. I learned in looking at the budget this year that even that $8 billion, the main program of that, the Community Development Block Grant, housing and urban development program for the poor was actually put up for elimination this year by the administration. That's about a $5 billion program. The other thing, though, I want to add in this is that there is this question of Karl Rove. And he is a complicated figure, and I will complicate the perception perhaps a bit more by saying this. The night after we had survived, my wife and I had survived this horrendous car wreck, and I was in the hospital and discovered I had a brain tumor. The first person to call me was Karl, which was surprising. And he said, "Hey, man, I know what you're going through." And I was sitting there on the phone thinking, "What?" He goes, I've spent more nights in a cancer ward than I can count. And I'm like, "What?" He said, "Yeah, my wife is a double breast cancer survivor, and I know what you're going through. And, you know, if there's anything that I can do, let me know." Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing to point out, because there is this, in politics these days, we seek easy portrayals of people. And I think one of the problems with that is when we seek easy portrayals, it makes it easier for us not to talk about policy or not to talk about broader issues. And my reason for telling this story or any of the other stories in the book is to try and tell the story and show the effect of a White House that is trying to, that has presented President Bush as sort of the pastor in chief, that has intentionally talked to Christians and told them that just because he's a man of faith, everything's going to be trusted. And that in turn they have, that they have taken in Christian leaders and tried to sell them on the idea of the exact same thing, on the importance of the president's faith, which is undoubtedly real. But there is a huge difference between personal faith and how we need to look at political office and make political criticisms.
Mm. David Kuo, you are disillusioned that the new money that you saw as promised never came, but the embrace of the Christian right certainly came in spades, and the political interest in that relationship was very intense. I wish you'd describe that for us. You paint a picture of a rather cynical use of that relationship. Now, there are certainly Christian right leaders who don't agree with your assessment. So how did you witness what you saw as political cynicism around the Bush administration's famous close relationship with the Christian right?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I got that. Repeat that, sort of the question.
You said the money wasn't there, but the embrace of the Christian right was. You portray it as quite cynical at any number of points in the book, saying this was exploitation, manipulation, temptation, seduction, all your words. So what was that use of the Christian right that came in your view without the beef of new money of programs that would actually deliver on the promise as you saw it?
Well, it's complicated. The Christian right was interested in a lot of different things from the White House, and some of the things that they wanted, they got, or they think they have received, at least. For instance, two new justices to the Supreme Court, and with them the hope that that certain things like overturning Roe versus Wade may well happen. And there are a number of other things that the White House has delivered, but most of what the White House has delivered on the social conservative agenda, frankly, has been rather symbolic. And it mirrors what it has done in so many different areas, faith-based being one of them. It seems the White House does just enough to get by, just enough to provide a certain amount of deniability for any accusation that it hasn't done something. And the key question is, what is the White House's true passion? What does it really want to advance? And what does it really want to achieve in policy terms? And it's a great mystery.
Let me take a call from Jackson, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I really wanted to reinforce a statement Mr. Kuo said earlier, and that is that Christians have trouble confusing George Bush with Jesus Christ, and this is something I have observed long back. And I think it would be simplified greatly for people if they would just go back to Jesus' words in the Bible and contrast what Jesus has told us to do with what is being done by this administration. And it cuts across all policy areas, not just what has or hasn't been done for the poor, but the way we conduct foreign policy and everything else. And I would refer people specifically to the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, where Jesus said to us, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." And Jesus exhorted us to lead by example, not by coercion.
Brenda, let me take that to David Koh, if I may, and thank you for your call. David Koh, how about it? Your first complaint is that the resources were not put there. What about the policies that were there themselves? Brenda says she sees, you know, a gap between Christian teaching and what's been exercised, what's been done. How do you see that?
You know, I think the danger is to take Jesus and politicize him in any way for any agenda. You know, Jesus stands on his own. You know, Jesus is, you know, comes with his own good news, and the simple good news that Jesus, you know, that Jesus says he came for, they're fairly simple, right? Good news is that, you know, he would die and be raised from the dead, and that we are to care for the poor, and that we are to love others as ourselves. You know, I'm not trying to be blasphemous. I think that's pretty clear what it's about.
Are you saying that cannot be exercised in government, or it simply wasn't exercised in this White House as you saw?
No, I think that Christian involvement in politics is crucial. I mean, you look at the civil rights movement, and without the involvement of Christians, it simply doesn't occur. You look at the abolition of slavery, without the involvement of Christians, you know, I'm sure at one point it will occur, but it, you know, occurs much sooner than it ever would otherwise. And so I'm hardly saying that Christians should not be ever involved in politics, but I just look now at the unbelievable politicization of politics and the divisiveness of politics and the use of Christian conservatives by voters who do not care about them. They care about their votes. They are starved for their votes, and they will say anything to get their votes.
Who's they?
Any politician who wants the Christian conservative vote. I mean, it's... Right. You go to one of these events. There was an event in Washington not too long ago, and you had different politicians seeking to be president come before it and try and say exactly the right things to give the impression that they are believers in Christ and that they are going to support the right program. And this idea that we're just going to deliver this whole Christian conservative voter bloc. And you know, it's the Christian conservatives who are being used. It's the moms and the dads. It's the people who give the $10 and the $15 and the $20 that are being used. And and I think that I think it's spiritually wrong. It's spiritually wrong, and I think that it corrupts the name of Jesus.
There's a pretty large charge. David Koh is with us. He was deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Community and Initiatives in the Bush White House 2001. To 2003, his new book is Tempting Faith, an Inside Story of Political Seduction. I want to turn for a moment, if I may, David, to Washington and a counterview. We're joined by Tom McCluskey. He's Vice President for Government Affairs at the Family Research Council. He's the organization's chief lobbyist. It's, of course, a very powerful group on the Christian right that's been very influential with this administration and has been very critical of you. Since you came out with these complaints in this book, Tom McCluskey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So here it is. David Koh was right there kind of in the heart of the matter, and he's come out and said this administration has not delivered. It's led the Christian right into temptation and seduction, and there's a betrayal afoot here. Your organization has responded quite negatively to that. How do you see what's going on, Tom?
Well, I've never had the pleasure of working with David. He was no longer there by the time I came on to the Family Research Council. But I'm taken aback. I think he's painting Christians as a little more naive than they actually are. This was a two-way street. Nobody was, if anybody was using anybody, it was using both ways. We realized that this administration, well, I believe that President Bush is a man of faith. I certainly wouldn't put all my faith in this administration in getting our agenda through.
So when David Koh says there's a failure here because President Bush promised compassionate conservatism, major new resources for the poor, and they were never delivered, are you saying that doesn't really matter? There are other things going on that leave you satisfied?
Well, with the faith-based initiative, I think that President Bush did do everything that he could do. He can't just throw around $1 billion here, $1 billion there without Congress's approval. And what we had fought for was faith-based protections in Congress, and without those, we're very wary of the faith-based program going forth if the organizations that are involved don't have the protections that are needed, and those, and having permanent protections, and not just by executive order. And that's why I think what you saw, the Washington Post a few weeks ago had a study that showed most of the money is going to more liberal churches within the inner cities and going for good causes, but it's not really going to the conservative churches that make up the so-called religious right.
David Kuo says it's become so bad that he strongly advises Christians to take a kind of time out for politics. Not that they shouldn't vote, but to just sort of simmer down for a couple of years here, step back from politics and contemplate what's going on. What's your answer to that?
I would think the timing could not be more wrong. It's ever more important that Christians have their voice in politics and in the government. For too long, we have been silent. For 30 years after Roe v. Wade, we've been too silent. We don't want to be the same way now that marriage is under attack. And with helping the poor also, government certainly has its role, except I personally believe it's a more personal thing than a governmental role. It's not the government coming in to spend a lot of money to help, but I believe that it's the hearts and the hands of the people within the churches that can do the most good.
David Kuo, what do you say? Tom McCluskey says perhaps you're naive and that important progress.
I never called David naive. I just said he was saying the voters might be naive.
David?
Tom, it's good to meet you, and thanks for doing this. I think one of the things that can be most damaging is to try and set bunch of people who love the same God in opposition to each other and try and make some sort of personal insinuations. And, I have every bit of faith that Tom has every bit of faith that I do and maybe practice it a lot better than I do. My concerns are exactly as I have stated. My point about the fast is not for Christians to step back and do nothing. Right? My point about the fast and the point of a fast in general is you stop doing something in order to focus on the spiritual.
Tom McCluskey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
David's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Kuo certainly sounds like a member of the church that I was raised in, although I don't recognize George Bush's Christianity at all. Maybe I should be more Christian and reach out to President Bush. But the thing that puzzles me is the question of who's been using whom all these years. And why the Christian right has been so patient with the corporate side of the Republican coalition. I mean, if you look at all the things that the Christian right is concerned about, you know, rising tide of hedonism and sexualization, if you had to point to one engine for why society is breaking down in the way they see it, it's because corporate America is using that culture to sell stuff. There's nothing more powerful than, you know, the advertising corporate machine for pushing the stuff that the Christian right is concerned about. Why have they been so patient with the other side of the Republican Party?
Let us pick that up. David Kuo, your response.
You know, it's such a great point. I mean, there are so many issues that are out there that are so profoundly moral and that so profoundly speak to the heart of what Jesus talked about. I think, though, one of the sad realities is, you know, why have Christians been so patient with Republicans? Because they have nowhere else to go. I think that Christians don't look to the Democratic Party and feel like they do not have a home there, and that's really a sad thing. You know, I grew up in a home in which my mom was a civil rights activist in the 1950s, worked on an interracial Christian commune down in Georgia, you know, where they were firebombed. And I grew up with this sense of civil rights. I grew up with a sense of the Democratic Party as the party that fought for the poor and fought for civil rights and was on the side of faith, obviously the civil rights movement. But somehow people of faith now don't feel like they're very welcome there in that party.
Democrats still talk a lot about government support and programs for the poor, about looking to the disadvantaged and engaging with them. Why does that leave you cold?
Well, it's more the prevailing attitude in the sense of the Democratic Party, the sense that someone, you know, the other day, I think it was Rosie O'Donnell, who went on television and, you know, said basically that Christians were like Al-Qaeda. And you know, I think that's the sense that Christians have about liberals and about Democrats. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why Christians are stuck with the Republican Party and one of the greatest concerns, because any particular constituent group that gets stuck with just one party compromises its power and its authority.
And you're very clear in saying that that relationship has gone wrong in your eyes. What about the question raised here by the caller of who's using whom in this relationship between the GOP and the Christian right? You heard Tom McCluskey with the Family Research Council saying that they're doing just fine, thank you, David Kuo.
I'm glad that they feel that way, but I think it's hard to look at the social statistics and support that data. You know, if you look at the social statistics that conservatives care about, in the last 30 years, abortions are pretty much all the same. Divorces, are generally the same, if not up. Obviously, the family is breaking down. Divorce, I mean, all of those social issues that people care about, you know, children born out of wedlock. You know, but in the last 30 years, I think, you know, forgive me if I'm slightly off on the statistics, but there's been a Republican president for, 20 of the last 28 years? You know, a vast majority of the justices on the Supreme Court have been appointed by Republicans. A Republican Congress has pretty much, Republicans have controlled pretty much both houses of Congress for the last 12 years, save for obviously the 2 years in 2001, 2002. In short, I think Christians have gotten everything they could possibly want. You know, but the evidence is obviously that you know, there are certain things that are simply beyond the power of government to influence. And you know, and my hope, speaking now obviously on the more political side of things, is that perhaps you know, the best way to achieve those isn't through politics. You know, maybe the best way to achieve those things is by taking this little step back from politics and by focusing more on individual service, focusing more on caring for people and you know, counseling people who are in the midst of going through divorce, helping women who are you know, in the midst of a crisis pregnancy, no matter what decision they make.
So direct action, not necessarily through, at the broadest level, the political path here. Let me get a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Bob, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just feel that the president has made some mistakes. We all do as Christians and members of other faiths. But as long as he keeps defending life in the womb, as long as the United States continues to be the most generous country in the world, I'd say we're not as far from the path we should be on as some people would have us believe.
So you're going to stick with it. What about the idea that Christians ought to step back from politics a little bit, Bob? What do you think of that?
I think the Democrats would love that, but I hope they don't.
We've got it. David Kuo, what about it? Says, you know, President Bush is still pro-life, against abortion, so that's nearly enough.
Well, here's just a sort of interesting thought that you know, I explore just at the very end of the book. You know, what if, you know, for people like the wonderful caller just now, you know, what if in the next 2 years, if Christians did this, you know, what would happen?
Did
to
what?
The,
that
you
is, step back from politics.
They took this step back from politics. You know, how confused would the mainstream media be? I mean, if they took a step back and said, you know what, we're gonna follow Jesus more. We're gonna work with the poor. We're gonna help the poor. We're gonna put Jesus' love into action for the next 2 years. We're gonna focus more on doing that than on these you know, hateful, divisive politics that you know, litter our televisions now. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, what would the mainstream media write about?
Is the media really the important issue here? Your message was aimed more at the GOP and the flock that you're part of.
No, I mean from a spiritual perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, because one of the things that Christian conservatives fear is the liberal media. One of the things I've been attacked on more than you can imagine from conservative friends is that I'm being used by the liberal media to destroy the Republican Party before these midterm elections. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I'm saying is, you know, what an extraordinary thing it would be if Christians took this step back and said, hey, you know, we're going to serve the poor. We're going to step back from politics. You know, what an amazing witness that would be to who Jesus is. As opposed to these divisive politics.
The question of who's using whom comes into high relief for me at certain points in the book. You write about a very cynical attitude in the sort of political boiler room inside the White House, people speaking rather derisively of Christian leaders. Is there a gulf in the White House between those who are sort of true believers and really on board and those who aren't? Or, you know, when it comes to politics, does the sacred get lumped in with everything else? What did you witness there? This talk about, you know, ridiculous, out of control, goofy, nuts, and all the rest.
No, I mean, there has been this continuing attitude in the White House and in most of the Republican circles in which I've worked, in which social conservatives are and Christian conservatives are viewed as, you know, as I say in the book, as nuts or goofy or, you know, I could have gone on with a whole list of other things that I've heard. It is just a constant drone and dribble and conversation that occurs. I mean, it's one of those things that's so constant that one doesn't even think about it when they're in conservative politics. And what strikes me so much about the White House's rebuttal, quote unquote, is to say it never, ever happened in any meeting ever that anybody ever heard about anything ever. And I don't know what that line is from Shakespeare, but, you know, methinks thou doth protesteth too much. I mean, everybody complains about everything at some point in time. And that's simply true. And, you know, if I could speak, one of the other points I make in the book, one of the sort of breakthrough moments of my life, if you will, was back in 1996, 97, I had just left working for John Ashcroft. And I'm going to abbreviate this with a much longer story in the book. But, you know, frankly, it was running into Hillary Clinton one evening in a private dinner that had an extraordinary impact. We had a brief conversation. I apologized to her for how much I'd hated her in my life and how many words I'd written about her in hateful ways. She was confused and uncertain, but it led to a rather extraordinary set of events, again, that I outline about, you know, her giving a speech asking for forgiveness herself. And that's one of the things that informs me in this, which is this possibility that that by taking this step back from politics and by recognizing that that George W. Bush really is not the same as God, and that God is not going to deliver better things through politics, that I think progress can be made on the spiritual front.
Let's go to Northborough, Massachusetts, and Bill. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, your guest got my blood up big time when he put down the Democrats when it came to religion and Christianity in general. Mm. Let me remind your guest, we were first and foremost in the civil rights area. We did come up with the Peace Corps. We did come up with the war on poverty. Mm-hmm. The one thing that Democrats insist on is that we be a non-denominational party. In other words, everybody is welcome and that it doesn't promote any particular religion. In other words, Democratic office holders uphold their oath of office, whereas President Bush and company do not.
And I guess the question is, are you inviting David over, Bill?
I would invite David over just so long as he understands that the whole point of government is to promote Christian programs, but not promoting Jesus.
Bill, thanks very much for your call. David Cole, what about, I mean, one thing that struck me here was you the faith-based initiative itself has been controversial in some quarters for getting religion involved in that kind of publicly funded outreach. You have no problem with that. In fact, you wanted more of it.
You know, I want to go back to what Bill said, because you know, what Bill was reacting to, I mean, and just obviously the anger in his voice, is I hope not something that he heard. You know, the Democratic Party was the greatest force for good on the behalf of the poor. Yes, civil rights movement. Yes, you know, the war on poverty. Yes, all of those things. Absolutely. What I was referring to is simply the perception that is out there that the Democratic Party is currently hostile to people of faith. The perception. That's all I was talking about.
Could the Democratic Party then be acceptable to a conservative Christian like you while remaining non-denominational, non-sectarian, as David suggests?
I think they have a lot of work to do. There's a scene I recount in the book where, you know, a very prominent Democrat goes up to a man named Rick Warren, who is the author of this book called The Purpose-Driven Life, that has sold
millions.
27, it's the biggest hardcover seller in American history. And he says to him, "Hey, what do you do?" And Rick Warren says, "You know, I pastor a church out in California." And the guy goes, "Oh, good, good, big church." He goes, yeah, it's a pretty good size. He goes, "Good, good. Well, good to meet you."
And this is Terry McCullough, you write in the book, passing by maybe the most prominent figure in the evangelical Christian community.
Yeah, and he says, "Hey, good, good. It's good. You know, a pastor in Orange County, supports Democrats. Great, good. Okay, bye." You know, and again, that just displays, you know, the fact that I think politically the Democrats have a bit of work to do. But again, in all of this, you know, I think that, you know, the driving point here is to understand, you know, this tension between faith and politics. And, you know, I write this blog now called Jaywalking for beliefnet.com. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of been chronicling some of the experiences during this time. And I was reading through some of the comments on it last night. And some of the comments are just, you know, have kept me going, frankly, because they encourage. But some of them are just, you know, these hate-filled things, like, you know, by raising these questions that I am, you know, literally satanic. A major Christian writer said, literally, I am now a member of the Axis of Evil, which makes me the only solo member of the Axis of Evil who doesn't have a country. But I think, you know, the reactions, just the hate from the Christians, has saddened me, mostly because it underscores this point that that God is supposed to come first. Politics is not supposed to come first. And whether it's 3 weeks before an election, whether it's election day, or whether it's, you know, 364 days till the next election, I think that it's important that God be placed first.
I can feel you smarting from those emails. Let's take a call from Waterloo, Iowa. Karen, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
What I'd like to make a point on is that with regard to the gentleman from Cedar Rapids talking about as long as they're pro-life, some of my dearest friends belong to an Assembly of God. Mm-hmm. They're the best people on the earth, and they will vote for the current administration as long as he's pro-life. And yet, you can tell them how many Iraqis alone have died. Over 3,000 of our young people are now dead, or our fathers, not all of them young. And you go into the church, my son is an active member of that church, and they wave the flag. The young people are very, very active inside the church about promoting the integrity of service. And the sad thing is, they're duped. They're duped. As long as this administration is in power, it won't be the administration's kids that go to war. It'll be theirs. They're the middle and lower class. The upper echelon of this administration has how many of its own serving? And how many of those 3,000 belong to those very people who have been lied to?
Karen, thanks very much for your call. David Kuo, Karen says, duped, and that's not so far from your words, tempted and seduced and manipulated. Give us your final advice to that community, the Christian right community. Here we are in the autumn of 06. What exactly are you suggesting?
You know, I think that there are certain lessons to draw from the book. I mean, there are a lot of lessons from the book. I think maybe one of the mistakes I made is trying to write this nuanced book that covers all these different things, and people are trying to pull out one after the other. But
it's in your title, you know, my friend, Tempted and Seduced.
Yeah, no, but it's a very, again, it's a very personal story, mm-hmm. from start till now. But you know, but for Christians who support this administration, understand that the idea that George W. Bush is the pastor in chief is not correct. You know, understand that this administration wants you for your votes. I mean, that's why it wants you. And hold the administration politically accountable, not spiritually accountable. Also, for everyone to understand, the betrayal of the compassion promise is a really, really significant promise. You know, not many people pay much attention to the poor or to promises made or broken on the poor. But if you were to go through and you document this, it's one of the most extraordinary broken promises of any administration in recent history.
David Kuo, former Deputy Director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in the White House, author of the new book, Tempting Faith, An Inside Story of Political Seduction. Mr. Kuo, thank you for joining us.
Thanks again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.